Ekatra Foundation presents the Ekatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to the Deep Dive.
Yeah.
Today, we're getting into a really remarkable and I think deeply revealing autobiography. It's an autobiography, The Story of My Experiments with Truth by Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi.
It really is quite a singular work. You know, it's not your standard chronicle of, say, political triumphs or the polished narrative you might expect from a figure like him, a saint almost.
Right, not a highlight reel.
Not at all. Instead, Gandhi presents his entire life as a kind of laboratory. Every single action, every decision, whether it's public or, you know, deeply private, he treats it as an experiment in this relentless quest he had for, well, absolute truth.
And that's what makes this deep dive so relevant for us today, isn't it? Even for those who know the basic story. We know him as Mahatma Gandhi, the anti-colonial leader, the spiritual guide, the architect of nonviolent resistance, Bapu, father.
That's the image, yes. Like, the great souled one.
But this book, it peels back those layers. It shows you how this profoundly shy, maybe even ordinary young man transformed into this global symbol. Someone capable of challenging empires, not with weapons, but just through moral authority, through truth.
Exactly. And it suggests it's not just about political change out there, but about personal liberation inside. It's almost a handbook for living by principle.
It really makes you wonder what transforms someone like that. So let's unpack his beginnings. Where does this journey start?
Well, it starts back in 1869 in Porbandar, Gujarat. His father, Karamchand, was a diwan, a chief minister, known for integrity, but also apparently quite a temper.
Ah, interesting contrast.
Yes. But it's his mother, Putlibai, who seems to have had this incredibly deep impact. She was a devout Vaishnava Hindu. That's a tradition emphasizing, you know, nonviolence, vegetarianism. And her life was marked by prayer, intense fasting, real devotion that really influenced young Mohandas.
And how did he describe himself as a child?
Painfully shy.
Yeah.
That comes across so strongly. Fearful, too afraid of ghosts, snakes, the dark. And by his own account, a pretty mediocre student.
Wow. It's hard to reconcile that with the later figure. But even then, you see these early moral tests, these experiments almost.
Absolutely. He's brutally honest about them. His marriage at just 13 to Kasturbai Kapadia, he admits it was driven initially by carnal desire, something he felt immense guilt about later.
And other transgressions.
Oh, oh yes. He talks about trying meat eating, which was against his Vaishnava beliefs. Petty theft, actually, to cover a brother's debt, even trying smoking. And each time, this wave of guilt just washes over him.
There's that pivotal story about the theft confession to his father, right?
Yes, that's huge. He's terrified, writes down the confession, hands it to his sick father, expecting, you know, fury.
And instead...
Instead, his father just reads it, cries silently, and forgives him. Gandhi calls it a living object lesson in ahimsa, nonviolence and truthfulness. It was profound for him.
And there was tragedy, too, wasn't there? His father's death.
A deeply formative and painful moment. He was only 16. His father was dying, and Gandhi was, in his own words, consumed by animal passion with his wife at that moment. The shame from that stayed with him, fueling his later commitment to self-control, to brahmacharya.
So carrying all this shyness, this guilt, these profound lessons, he then makes this incredibly bold move, London, 1888. For law school.
Right, and it was a big deal. Going against his community's wishes, because crossing the dark water, the ocean, was seen as violating caste rules. For someone so shy, that was his first real act of, well, rebellion.
And London itself must have been overwhelming.
Oh, completely. Massive culture shock. You picture this awkward, young, vegetarian Indian man dropped right into the heart of the British Empire.
Did he try to fit in?
He did, initially. Bought expensive suits, took lessons in dancing, elocution, even the violin, trying to become the perfect English gentleman.
How long did that last?
Not long. He pretty quickly saw it was futile and expensive. So he consciously returned to a simpler life, focusing on his studies.
But London wasn't just about law, was it? It seems like a crucial period for his thinking, his spirituality.
Hugely important. It's there he first reads Sir Edwin Arnold's English translation of the Bhagavad Gita. That book became, he said, his infallible guide of conduct.
And other influences.
He encountered Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. The ideas there, especially about turning the other cheek, resonated deeply with his understanding of ahimsa, nonviolence.
Interesting mix.
And his vegetarianism shifted too. It became less about tradition and more a moral philosophy. He joined the London Vegetarian Society. That was actually his first taste of public organizing, writing pamphlets, giving talks.
So he's developing these skills, these ideas. But then he returns to India in 1891, and professionally.
It didn't go well. His shyness was crippling in court. He literally couldn't speak up during his first case. He tried setting up practices in Rajkot, then Bombay, but failed. He felt completely adrift.
Which leads him, almost out of desperation, it sounds like, to South Africa in 1893. Just a one-year legal contract initially?
Exactly. An escape route, maybe. But South Africa turned out to be the place where Gandhi, the activist, was truly forged.
And it happens almost immediately, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The Pieter Maritzburg train incident.
Right away. Holds a first-class ticket, gets told to move to third class purely because of his race. He refuses. They physically throw him off the train.
It's just left thing.
Left shivering in a cold station waiting room all night. And you can just imagine that raw humiliation, the injustice becoming intensely personal. It wasn't abstract anymore.
That's the moment, isn't it? The choice point.
That's the moment. He decides right there. He's not running away. He's going to stay and fight this deep disease of color prejudice. That night changed everything.
From private individual to public mission. And South Africa becomes his, well, his laboratory for the next two decades.
Absolutely. He starts organizing the Indian community almost immediately, founds the Natal Indian Congress in 94, launches the newspaper Indian Opinion. This is where he develops Satyagraha.
Explain that again, Satyagraha.
It means truth force. It's active nonviolent resistance, civil disobedience. It wasn't passive acceptance. It was about actively opposing injustice, but without violence.
So campaigns against unfair laws.
Yes. Laws requiring Indians to register be fingerprinted. He organized mass marches. People burned their registration cards. They willingly went to jail. Courting arrest became part of the strategy.
And he was also experimenting with lifestyle, right? The settlements?
Phoenix Settlement, Tolstoy Farm.
Yep.
Yes. Communal living, self-sufficiency, everyone doing manual labor, living very simply, austerely, testing his ideals in practice.
And a huge personal step in 1906.
The vow of brahmacharya, celibacy, renouncing sexual relations, even with his wife, though with her consent, he says. He felt it was necessary to dedicate himself fully to public service, linking back perhaps to that earlier shame, wanting complete self-mastery.
So when he finally returns to India in 1915, he's not the same failed lawyer who left. He's a known figure.
A very renowned figure. But he follows the advice of his political mentor, Gokhale, and spends a full year just traveling India, listening, observing.
Why is that so important?
To really understand the reality on the ground, the depth of poverty, the stranglehold of untouchability, the true feel of colonial subjugation, he needed to see it, feel it before acting.
And then he establishes his base.
Sabarmati Ashram, based on his core principles, truth, nonviolence, celibacy, service to others, it became the nerve center.
And his first major campaigns in India, they proved Satyagraha could work there too.
Yes. Champaran in 1917, helping indigo farmers. Ahmedabad in 1918, supporting textile workers on strike. Kedah, also 1918, for peasants needing tax remission. Each one demonstrated the power of his method and really cemented his leadership on a national scale.
And the book itself, the autobiography, it ends around 1921.
Right in the middle of the first big nationwide non-cooperation movement, which followed the horrific Jallianwala Bagh massacre in 1919. Indians boycotting British goods, courts, schools, mass mobilization. The book leaves him right there, fully immersed in the struggle.
Let's dig into the philosophy behind all this action. What were the absolute core beliefs driving him? You mentioned truth, Satya.
Satya was absolutely central, ultimate reality. And he had this fascinating shift. Initially, he might say, God is truth. But later, he profoundly reversed it. Truth is God.
What's the significance of that reversal?
It's huge. It means the pursuit of truth, in whatever form, is a spiritual path. It's not about dogma. It's about relentless, honest investigation of reality. That makes the pursuit universal, open to anyone, believer or non-believer. His life, his experiments were all about trying to align himself with that fundamental reality.
So if truth is the goal, the ultimate reality, what's the path?
The path is ahimsa, nonviolence. But again, it's not passive. It's not cowardice. For Gandhi, it's the supreme virtue, an active force needing incredible courage.
More than just not hitting someone.
Much more. It's about purging your own mind of anger, of hatred. The ideal Satyagrahi, the practitioner of this, aims to convert the opponent through love and, crucially, through their own self-suffering, not by inflicting suffering.
And brahmacharya fits in how?
He saw it as total self-control, with celibacy being a key part. Essential for spiritual growth, yes, but also for effective public service. Conserving your vital energy, he believed, allowed for greater focus, greater power in your work. That 1906 vow was tied directly to serving humanity more effectively.
And the fourth pillar, Sarvodaya.
Yes, welfare of all. He got this idea partly from reading John Ruskin's Unto This Last. It's about uplifting every single person, especially, as he put it, the last and the least.
So not just majority rule.
Definitely not. He rejected that utilitarian idea, the greatest good for the greatest number. Sarvodaya says everyone matters. This fueled his fight against untouchability, he called those excluded Hurrigans, children of God, and his push for rural self-sufficiency, Swaraj, at the village level.
When you look at all this, what was the ultimate driver? Was it Indian independence or something else?
The ultimate goal for him was personal spiritual liberation, moksha, to see God face to face, as he put it. Everything else, the legal work, the political activism, the social reform, was secondary, a means towards that spiritual end.
Even Swaraj, independence.
Even Swaraj had a deep spiritual dimension for him. It meant self-rule, not just for India as a nation, but for each individual. Mastering your own mind, your passions, creating a society based on ethics, self-reliance, decentralized power. Political freedom was necessary, absolutely, but it wasn't enough. It was a step towards that deeper inner freedom.
How did he handle setbacks? Failure? Adversity seems almost built into his method.
He absolutely saw adversity as opportunity, an essential part of the experiment. Think about turning the other cheek. It wasn't about weakness. It was about absorbing the suffering, like at Peter Maritzburg. He genuinely believed that voluntarily taking on suffering could melt the opponent's heart, awaken people's conscience.
And when his own movements went wrong, like when violence broke out during non-cooperation.
He didn't blame others. He looked inward. He undertook long fasts for self-purification, literally blaming his own spiritual shortcomings for the failures of the movement. External problems for him often reflected internal struggles.
Fascinating. And Satyagraha itself was his system for dealing with conflict.
Yes, it was his structured methodology, almost scientific in its approach. You carefully study the situation, you try negotiation first, you educate the public, then you resort to nonviolent direct action. But the goal was always reconciliation, finding a solution that respected everyone's dignity, not just winning.
Okay, we've traced his path and philosophy. Let's zero in on three moments that weren't just events, but points where he was fundamentally changed. Turning points. First, back to that train ejection, Peter Maritzburg, 1893. Why was that so transformative beyond the immediate shock?
Because it turned abstract prejudice into a visceral personal wound. He was faced with a choice: run away in humiliation or stand and fight. That choice, made shivering in that waiting room, forged his identity as a public activist. It shifted him irrevocably from focusing on his own career to embracing a mission for social justice. It set the course for everything that followed, really.
Okay, second turning point, the vow of Brahmacharya in 1906. A deeply personal act, but why was it pivotal for his public life?
It was pivotal because, for Gandhi, it represented the peak of self-mastery. He believed conquering his deepest physical urges was essential to dedicating himself completely to service, to seva. It was about channeling all his energy, physical and mental, into his mission. This act, this internal struggle and discipline, became fundamental to his persona as Mahatma, the great soul who had mastered his senses. It gave him immense moral authority.
It changed how people saw him and how he saw himself.
Absolutely. And it changed his relationship with his wife, Kasturbai, making it, in his view, a spiritual partnership.
And the third turning point, that first Satyagraha campaign, 1906-1908, against the Black Act in the Transvaal. Why was this specific campaign so crucial?
Because it was the birth of Satyagraha, not just as an idea, but as a mass political weapon. It was the first time he organized large-scale civil disobedience based explicitly on nonviolence and the willingness to suffer the consequences, like imprisonment.
And he actually coined the term then.
Yes, precisely to distinguish it from passive resistance. He wanted to emphasize its active, moral, truth-based force. This campaign proved his philosophy could work in the real world, against a government. It tested him as a leader, he went to jail multiple times, and crucially, it worked. It forced the government to negotiate and eventually repeal the act. That success validated his method and gave him the blueprint for India.
Looking back at this incredible life filled with struggle and transformation, what are the big human lessons we can take away, things that resonate with us today?
I think one major thing is that real integrity, the kind that can influence the world. It starts small. It starts with those private acts. His obsession almost with his diet, his schedule, his personal honesty. That wasn't just eccentricity.
It was training.
Exactly. Training for immense self-discipline. He shows you that character is forged in those seemingly mundane, everyday experiments with truth.
That's powerful. And what about his vulnerability? The way he lays bare his flaws in the book, the lust, jealousy, temper, his mistakes as a husband and father.
That's maybe the most striking lesson. Vulnerability is a source of strength. The book's impact comes from that radical honesty. It tells us leadership isn't about pretending to be perfect. It's about acknowledging your flaws and committing to relentless self-improvement. That's what makes him relatable, human.
And the idea that the means shape the end.
Absolutely critical. You can't achieve a noble goal using ignoble methods. You can't build peace with violence or achieve justice through deceit. The methods you use become embedded in the result. It's a tough lesson, but profound. And tied to that, the idea that real change starts inside. You want to change the world first, change yourself.
Are there specific insights for leadership, maybe in a professional context, that jump out?
Well, certainly the power of moral authority. His leadership wasn't based on position or force. It was earned through integrity. People followed him because his life was an open book, and he lived by the principles he preached. Trust is the ultimate currency.
And his approach upon returning to India.
The power of listening. Spending that whole year just observing before acting. That's a huge lesson. Understand the problem. Understand the people before you jump to solutions. Deep listening is a leadership tool.
And seeing conflict differently.
Yes. Not as a battle to be won, but as an opportunity to uncover truth, to transform relationships. Satyagraha's aim wasn't just victory. It was to convert the opponent, leading to a better understanding, reconciliation.
So bringing it to today, we live in this age of, well, polarization, misinformation, a lot of online noise. Why does Gandhi's story, his approach, still matter so much?
Perhaps more than ever. His insistence on truth, Satya, as something real and discoverable, feels like an antidote to our post-truth anxieties. Ahimsa, nonviolence, offers a desperately needed alternative to these endless cycles of violence and revenge we see everywhere.
And the focus on the internal.
That emphasis on self-reflection, on personal accountability, it's such a contrast to the focus on public image, on performance, often at the expense of private integrity. His life is just this powerful reminder that maybe the strongest force for change isn't political power or technology, but simply the unwavering courage of a single human conscience trying its best to live truthfully.
As we wrap up this deep dive, let's distill it down. Here are three final takeaways from Mohandas Gandhi and the story of my experiments with truth. An emotional insight. The deepest wounds are often self-inflicted, but their honest confession is the first step toward healing. Gandhi's greatest act of courage wasn't facing down an empire, but facing himself. He shows us that when we have the bravery to confess our shame, like his guilt at his father's deathbed, we transform our personal pain into universal wisdom. His vulnerability is not a weakness, it is the source of his enduring power.
An intellectual insight. Gandhi's most revolutionary idea was perhaps reversing that old saying, God is truth. By declaring that truth is God, he created a truly universal and inclusive path. It wasn't tied to any specific religion or dogma. This simple inversion turned spirituality into something almost scientific, a relentless pursuit of reality. His life becomes the experiment, politics the laboratory, and the goal isn't proving a belief, but discovering what's fundamentally real and true.
A universal insight. We often think we need to change the world out there, but Gandhi's life teaches us the revolution has to start within. The means we use inevitably become the ends we create. You simply cannot build a peaceful society using violent means or a just society using unjust ones. His life stands as powerful proof that the state of the world is, in so many ways, a reflection of our own inner state. That's where the real work begins. Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.